You're listening to the Miles to Go podcast, the go-to source for travel tips, news, and reviews you can't afford to miss. Now, here's your host, travel expert Ed Pizza.
Welcome back to another episode of the Miles to Go podcast, where we bring you the latest travel news, tips, and tricks each week to help you save money and travel better. We've got a new guest this week. It's the first time on the podcast for Grant Martin. Grant writes about the airline and hotel industries, focusing on loyalty for publications like Skift, Forbes, and the New York Times. He and I enjoy a good Twitter conversation now and then with equal parts analysis and sarcasm. Grant digs into the business of loyalty, how the airlines and hotels use their loyalty programs to influence customer behavior, and ultimately how that affects their bottom line. He stopped by to talk about recent changes to both American Airlines and United Airlines' top-tier elite programs and how the spending level required for business travelers is going up significantly and how that's going to affect those guys. Jen is back also to talk about Hilton's latest promotion. It's a bit better than the new normal and might be worth your attention. Lastly, we have Michael Traeger back on the show to talk about Vegas casino loyalty. There's nobody I know who knows more about casino loyalty than Michael. He thinks there are some things wrong with the current system, and he knows how to change it for the better. He's also working on a new project that will help you earn miles and points without stepping foot on an airplane or in a hotel, and I try to pry some of those details out from him in this episode. The segments with Grant and Michael are a bit longer than normal because we just sort of got off on a tangent. They were both interesting segments to record. Lost track of time a bit, but they're both worth a listen. As you guys know, we love helping more people travel better, and that begins with you. If you're enjoying the show, share it with a friend, and be sure to drop us a line and let us know who we should have on future episodes and what questions we can help you answer. You can email me, ed@pizzainmotion.com, and you can find us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by searching Miles to Go. You can also leave us a voicemail. There's an orange tab on the website that says send a voicemail. Just click on that. You can record a question for us to answer in a future episode. With all that wrapped up, we'll be right back with my interview with Grant on the Miles to Go podcast. Back on the Miles to Go podcast, and you guys have heard us talk a little bit here and there about United Airlines and American Airlines making changes to elite status, specifically at the top tier. United jumped into the pool first and raised the minimum spend required for 1K status, their top tier status, from $12,000 a year to $15,000. And then American waited a few weeks and jumped in right after. It's been a hot topic for some of the most hardcore business travelers, both here and on my blog. I wanted to bring on Grant Martin from Skift because he wrote a piece recently on this subject, and he had some interesting conclusions from the folks that he talked to. Grant, thanks for coming on Miles to Go for the first time. Hopefully we'll be able to have you on again more frequently in the future.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ed.
So for folks that may not be familiar with Grant, he covers the travel industry in a way that I always find interesting, in that he's knowledgeable about, you know, whether it's United or American or Marriott or Starwood, but he also likes to take apart these decisions. So I'm not 100% sure where you started on this specific piece, but my bet is that when you started looking at this, you probably thought that more people were going to be concerned about the change from $12,000 in required spending to $15,000.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and I think it's partially because, you know, people like you and I live in a bubble and we're surrounded by these people all the time. You know, you think about your bubbles that we are on social media, right? In your Twitter and your Facebook, like, are we all right or are we all left? In our case, I think, you know, we're surrounded by travel enthusiasts, but we're also surrounded by people who are really passionate about loyalty programs and consumer protection as well. So I think when I went into this story, I was expecting to see a little bit more of the outrage that I had seen firsthand manifested on paper. And I expected to talk to a lot of these business travelers and for them to say, you know, this is really going to change and affect the way that I'm traveling next year. And I'm not sure if I'll be able to do it the same. But what I ended up finding out was that's actually really not the case.
Yeah, and I think part of that is, you know, we're obviously still in something of a, I believe we're still in a booming economy. There are certainly some signs that that may not be the case. There have been some fits and starts with the market over the past few weeks. I think a lot of business travelers get into this mode of, you know, whatever the new normal is. And so I think that they, the folks that you interviewed, which I think are a big cross section of who's out there, believe that their 2019 travel will look a lot like their 2018 travel, both in how much it costs to get from Chicago to Phoenix, and that, you know, that they're going to be traveling, you know, if they traveled 25 times in 2018, they're going to travel 25 times in 2019. And I think, you know, you and I have certainly been around this industry long enough to know that those things are both true until they're not.
Yeah. I mean, and to be clear, the conclusion, I mean, by and large, the conclusion of this article was that most business travelers don't really seem to care that much about the qualification criteria going up by 25% next year. So, you know, as it is right now, you pay $12,000 a year. Next year, you have to pay $15,000 a year to qualify for 1K or Executive Platinum. And at large, the response I got from many business travelers was big deal, right? And I think your theory about them not caring that much about or expecting the economy to stay strong next year may hold true. But I think it's also just got to do with people's you know, general habits around travel and general habits around booking last minute tickets and booking business class tickets. So one thing I think I perhaps underestimated was the amount of premium fares that are purchased by business travelers. Now, as a person who's worked at many startups before, I'm used to booking the lowest fare bucket, you know, tickets out there. This is the $99 one-way fare on, you know, Spirit or the K or the Z fare or whatever. Whatever is really cheap, right? And as an example, and one of the guys I interviewed is a guy named Tim Stevens, who's the editor-in-chief of Roadshow over at CNET. And in his case, he buys a lot of last-minute fares. This is book it 2 or 3 days before a shoot or 2 or 3 days before he's got to go check out a car or go to a meeting. And intrinsically, those fares are just expensive. You know, yeah. He's flying from Albany to Djibouti or, you know, some far-off place, and the ticket, you know, automatically is going to cost $3,000, right? It's going to go into a high fare class fare, which means he's going to get bonus points, bonus miles, et cetera. And for him, he's not even looking at his numbers over the course of the year. It just shows up that he's 1K or Diamond or Executive Platinum, and he's not even worried about it.
Yeah, and I also think, too, this is more so on the United side of things. I do think one trailing side effect we'll see is that United has reduced the amount of preferred qualifying miles that business travelers, well, all travelers, but, you know, most specifically business travelers can earn on certain discounted first class tickets. And I do think when you talk about last minute travel, I'll frequently see that, specifically with United, that the discounted first class tickets are almost the same price as coach. And in some cases, I'd say probably 15% of the time, they'll actually be cheaper. A discounted first class ticket with some restrictions on cancellation will actually be cheaper sometimes than the full fare coach ticket that's still available. So I do think you'll see some folks who will earn less total PQMs for premier qualifying miles or dollars based on how those tickets fare out next year. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, how things will look in the future, as you say, some folks just sort of get onto the hamster wheel, if you will, and at the end of the year, they're 1K or whatever. If we did see a fare correction in the market, which I do think is unlikely. I think even if the economy turns down, I think the airlines have done a good job of controlling capacity. But if we did see a fare correction in the market, they could be buying those same last minute fares and not get to 15,000. I still think it would need to go higher than that, but I still think this is more likely. If we're going to hear an outrage, it's probably going to be October or November of 2019.
Right. Well, what I was initially worried about when United announced its changes to status qualification criteria was that what they've done is they've changed the criteria to go from $12,000 to $15,000, but they've left the mileage criteria the same at 100,000 miles per year. And in changing the spend requirement, they're putting themselves more on a competitive playing field with Delta. So Delta, to reach their Diamond status, which is their highest, you know, elite tier, you need $15,000 of spend and 125,000 miles. So those two products are now a little bit more comparative on the surface as loyalty programs. But as products themselves, Delta, by and large, is a much nicer airline and experience than United is. So how can you have two loyalty programs that are very similar in competition when you have two products that are so different?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about the difference between the two products. And I think you could even argue the loyalty programs are fairly different in terms of how Delta prices their miles and their awards. I think the difference there is that the typical Delta customer is so happy with the product that they're getting, whether that's the in-flight product, you know, soft goods, customer service, what have you, that they're a little bit less tied to the value that they get from the miles. And I think when you line the differences up, I do think that even though the spend requirement for United and Delta are the same at 15,000 miles per year, I think Delta's requirement for 125,000 flown miles is a much more important barrier. And this certainly goes back to the discounted premier qualifying miles for discounted first class fares on United as well, is that, you know, even for me, I don't, you know, if I'm doing it mostly, 1 mile per mile flown, 125,000 flown miles on one carrier in a year does really start to stretch how much I could rack up.
See, this is where we're different, actually. And this is why I was expecting there to be more pushback to the raise in spend. I finished this year as an executive platinum. Well, let me back up 2 weeks. I was about to finish this year as an executive platinum with 100,000 miles and about $9,500 in spend, which is, you know, $2,500 less than I should have had to, or that I need to spend to get executive platinum. So I wouldn't have made it, is the moral of the story. And, you know, I figured it out a few months ago and I got the, you know, Barclays Aviator card and I put the necessary spend on there and I got my spend up so that I was able to reach the spending threshold. But like, I was under by several thousand dollars, and that is just with my normal day-to-day half business, half recreation travel. I wasn't even penny pinching. I wasn't even booking like, you know, $90 super cheap fares to Europe. This is just like my normal travel life. And
sure,
what I was expecting was that more people would be in a similar category to me, where through personal and business spend, they would still be under the annual spending limit, and that would become a problem. But perhaps that's not the same for everybody. I mean, where did you finish the year?
Yeah, so two things there. First off, I finished the year on United at 140,000-ish premier qualifying miles. I feel like I have one flight that hasn't posted that's a small number of miles, but it'll be somewhere around that mark and well over 15,000. I haven't run the number. I can find it in my United account, but the basic screen just shows whether you're over $12,000 or not. And when I looked at one point when they raised to 15,000, I was well clear of that number. I don't know that I'll be clear of 20 for the year, but I may be. I had a couple of overseas flights that weren't on United, which would be interesting. Like if I was close to that 15,000, do I fly TAP Portugal knowing I can't get any premier qualifying dollars for that fare? Do I need to fly United to make sure I get my $15,000? And so I think there could be some decisions that pop up like that in the future, you know, but to your comment of, you know, where you finished the year, I think there's two interesting things there. First off, you availed yourself of a credit card option to boost your elite qualifying dollars with American, and that choice won't be available to you next year. You're going to be able to do that to a much lesser quantity based on how American has changed things. So it gets harder for you to hit that number next year. On top of the change from 12 to 15,000, you now earn less premier qualifying dollars through credit cards, and your travel was right around 100,000 flown miles. If you were a Delta customer, you know, did you have enough other extraneous travel to squeeze another 25,000 miles onto one carrier?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible I wouldn't be able to. Oh, and there is a loophole with the Aviator MasterCard, right? So I actually applied for the Aviator MasterCard in the 3-month window this year that allows me to extend the qualifying dollar benefit to next year. But even so, I mean, I'm not going to be able to get up to 15,000 miles next year, so it doesn't matter. In terms of making it to 125,000 miles this year, you know, it was a little bit light for me this year because I just had a son and I've been in the process of moving, so my travel has been a little bit lighter than it usually is. So I think in other years I could have, but this year probably it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I think, you know, like I said, I think it can be done. Like, just say for me, I was at 140, but I think I also had, you know, half a dozen flights on Southwest. I had a half a dozen on Delta. I had a couple of Frontiers in there. I think I had a Spirit. I had, you know, 9 or 10 Americans. So I could certainly do 125 in most cases, but I think, you know, you start to have to think about where all that stuff goes, especially when you think about the dollars that you might pay for some of those fares. And I think the airlines are making a bet that we as a business/leisure travelers will want to consolidate more of those flights with one carrier. I think the unfortunate and untested thing here is, you know, let's use you as an example right now. You're not going to be top tier on American next year. You're going to miss. So how do you think that affects your travel for next year? Do you still try to put 75,000 on American, or are you a free agent now?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I have these romantic ideas of giving up everything and, you know, writing one last article for the New York Times about how travel once used to be great. Now I only travel by Greyhound bus everywhere. But I think the fact of the matter is the more likely scenario is that since I'm lifetime gold on American, I will start to travel like a normal person. I'm starting to think about the concept of, well, what is it like potentially not needing to be on an aircraft every 2 weeks or 3 weeks? What's it like not necessarily trying as hard as possible to be on an American flight connecting through Dallas if I could always connect, take a direct flight if need be? So I'm going to probably end up making a lot more logic-oriented decisions next year rather than loyalty-oriented decisions. And if I happen to get close to 100,000 miles or executive platinum, then I'll go for it. But at this point, I think family and sanity is going to start to take a bit of a higher role. And, you know, the airline has kind of forced that in a way, because I'm starting to believe that a lot of these decisions are no longer logical.
Yeah, I do think that's the case. And I think that there's a smaller subset of folks like you and I that look at the horizon for decisions like this and are saying exactly what you're saying, which is I'll probably make different decisions in 2019. And I do think we're a minority. I don't think it's as small as the minority of folks that you and I see on Twitter who were railing against the move from 12 to 15, but, you know, certainly less than half, you know, maybe 25 or 30% of the business travelers out there, I think, sort of look at the horizon the way that we do. And I think the other group fall sort of in what you were intimating earlier, where they're going to continue to do what they do for business travel. And I think when they get to a certain point of the year that they don't or they can't qualify under the new qualifications, I think there's the potential for a larger break with the airline, with somebody that they had under their fold, and they moved the goalpost just a bit too far. And instead of continuing to get 100,000 miles from, you know, Jane or John Traveler on those routes, they, as you say, start to, you know, think more logically about their choices, because they're not going to make top tier. And so, you know, the Uniteds and the Americans of the world may get 50,000 from that person or 20. You know, that certainly would happen with me a couple of years ago when American changed their program. I was 100,000 miles with American every year for a decade, and I haven't been over 25,000 in the past 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're both pointing to is the question of how hard can they push us until they reach the tipping point? You know, and I think they raised the limit by $3,000 this year, and I think based on our research and what we've picked up from the community, it's made an impact, but it's not going to be, you know, we're not going to be riding out in the streets of Paris and flipping over cars at this point.
No, but I will be. I will be interested to see. Like, when we're sitting here, we should revisit this at the end of 2019 and say, you know, can we ascertain any changes in pattern? You know, do people, sure. You know, have more people moved away from the loyalty model? Can we see noticeable changes, or do the airlines dial stuff back because they see it and they give us those signals that they realize they went too far?
Well, they certainly don't have an incentive to keep us around right now, with the way the fares are structured and the way that they're making money. So
yeah,
that formula may change at some point when the economy changes. But for now, we seem to be collateral damage. What I did think was interesting in the article that I wrote was that, I feel like a lot of business travelers out there actually welcome the changes, because to them, since they're spending so much money and flying so much with the airline anyway, it's an advantage if there are fewer people around to take the perks from them. So I actually got a lot of feedback from business travelers that they're glad the changes are coming down the line.
Yeah, and I've heard that as well. And I would say unequivocally, and I have said this here both on the podcast and on the blog, they're all wrong. and I couldn't make that any more clearly. No reason to sugarcoat it whatsoever. Because here's the deal: these are publicly held companies that are looking to manage the quarter and, you know, improve their earnings by improving the share price of their company. And they have an algorithm today, and that algorithm says X percent of seats are going to go to elite members, and the rest of them we're going to monetize. And if they cut down the total number of elite members, and that formula worked for them before. Trust me when I say, the folks that run these programs are not going to look up and go, you know what we should do? We should give more seats to elite members. If 7% of elite members were getting upgrades before, they're gonna crimp it down some more and twist that percentage. I just don't see a place where I understand the methodology. Don't get me wrong. I totally understand why they say what they say, that the elite members are saying, well, we're going to get more upgrades. But the reality of it is that if an airline can get away with giving away the occasional seat for an upgrade today, then they're just going to replicate that same formula and put a little bit more money to the bottom line tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're just going to keep pushing us until there's this larger scale revolt, if you will. And right now, I don't necessarily see that on the horizon. I see people like myself and a few other half budget, half leisure, half recreational travel people who are, I'm not sure if the term is sad, but just disappointed about the changes. But up until this point, I haven't seen a lot of real anger on the horizon.
No, and when you take, let's take a guy like Scott Kirby from United Airlines. He's a spreadsheet guy. He's one of the guys that has made a big difference in the profitability of the industry, both through consolidation and through cost control. If he believes that trimming the elite ranks means he can also find a way to squeeze a little bit more money out of a few seats here and there, he's going to do that. If he can sell that seat, that's his goal. They've all said that in one way, shape, or another. All the CEOs of the airlines have said that in one way, form, or another. They want to sell more of those seats up front, which is one of the biggest perks that they give to their elite members. And I just don't see those formulas coming back in favor of the customer. Love to be proven wrong in 2019. I don't think I will be.
Well, they're certainly not in favor of people like you and me right now. I think that they are in favor of some spendier travelers. But the big question I raised, I don't know if it's been in the article that I wrote or if it was just more recently in general, is, does a person need to be wealthy or need to be a spendier traveler, a business class traveler, or a $20,000 a year traveler to be loyal? And I think my argument is that they don't have to. I think that some of your most enthusiastic, most loyal, most loving customers are actually your budget travelers, these people who just love to be out there taking pictures of airplanes, talking to pilots. And, rich travelers can be like this too. But I think that by preventing some of these younger, earlier stage, more thrifty travelers from being loyal to the airline creates a potential gap in the future that these people could fill in.
Yeah, I think you need all of those to make a good airline, both the budget customers, the business customers, and everybody in between. I think there's a balance. And
yeah, if I was starting the loyalty game right now, I started, 15, 20 years ago at Northwest Airlines, right, as a silver elite member out of Detroit. And I worked my way up to whatever platinum or diamond it was there. And every year I worked harder and became more loyal to the airline. And the only way I was able to do that was by not necessarily working the system, but flying a lot and learning how it worked and, becoming a better and more loyal traveler. If the first barrier to entry is so high that I can't even get in the future, the door's already closed and I'm just never going to start that long, slippery slope to where I am right now.
Yep, I agree. There was a time when lots of us made irrational decisions and the airlines were good at making those irrational decisions. And I think by and large, we make less irrational decisions today collectively than we did before. And we'll just have to see if that pattern holds. I'm going to hold you to, I hope that we're on a lot sooner than this, but I'm going to hold you to, we need to have this same conversation November, December of next year after we've talked to business travelers and see how much the behavior changes.
Yeah, and I'm committed to taking that call or joining the podcast from seat 74E next to the bathroom, as I will not have elite status anymore. But I'll be there, and I'll be following the loyalty industry all year. I'll keep you appraised of how it goes.
I want a picture of you in 74E. And when you're not hopping on the podcast with me or sitting in seat 74E, tell folks where they can find you.
Oh, yeah. Primarily, I'm the loyalty editor for Skift. Skift is a B2B, but largely a B2C travel intelligence company. I work in the editorial department there. I run our business of loyalty newsletter, but I also contribute just on the regular loyalty beat. You can also find me on the Twitters under Grant K. Martin, where I'm often talking to folks like Ed about loyalty, and over at Forbes, where I contribute a few times a month.
Yeah, and take it from me as a guy who spends a lot of time on Twitter, Grant is definitely a fun Twitter follow. Well, Grant, thanks.
Trying to make the community a little bit nicer every day.
Thanks a bunch for being on the podcast with us, Grant. Safe travels, and hopefully we'll have you back on again soon.
Yeah, it was great joining you, Ed. Take care.
We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast. While we're taking a quick break from the show, I wanted to let you know about our monthly Amazon gift card giveaway. Each month, we're going to give a $50 Amazon gift card to one of our mailing list subscribers. As long as you stay subscribed, you'll have a chance to win each time we have a giveaway. We'll always send you the best travel info, and we'll never sell your email address to anyone. You can subscribe right on our homepage, milestogo.boardingarea.com. Back on the Miles to Go podcast with Jen, back for another It's a Big Deal segment. And we're talking credit cards today. Lots and lots of great credit card offers. Hey, Jen, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Ed, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a bunch of great stuff out there, almost like I can't keep up with all of it. There's just so many new, not only new cards, but new offers. And so you've got a post that outlines a bunch of them. Let's go through some of your favorites right now for the listeners.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just the past few months, a ton of new offers have come out, which is rare to see in such a short time frame. So this is a great opportunity for people to, you know, look at the different offers, find out which cards are best for them for their upcoming, you know, travel, and to apply and to really rack up some free points and miles for free travel.
Yeah. And I think there really is a pretty wide, pretty wide variety of cards out there right now.
Right. I agree. There's pretty much a card for everyone, whether you spend a lot, don't spend a lot, want to, you know, airlines, hotels, just general flexible points used on any travel purchases. There really is a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, I agree. So what are some of your favorites right now?
So right now, one of the really like big promotions is from Capital One. So there's two different Capital One cards that are pretty much providing you the same bonus offer. It's just when you get miles and when you get cash back. The only downside is that these are business cards, and getting approved for business cards with Capital One isn't so easy unless you truly have a business, and still sometimes that's even challenging. But with both of these offers, the Capital One Spark Miles and the Capital One Spark Cash, you can get up to $200,000 points, which is worth $2,000 in travel or cash back, which is pretty unbelievable for just a regular card.
Yeah, and I don't know that I've ever had a Capital One card. I mean, maybe many, many years ago, but certainly not while I've been in the game. And I think the interesting thing here is, like, don't get me wrong, not that 200,000 miles, Capital One miles, isn't pretty darn awesome from a sign-up bonus standpoint, but Capital One just rolled out a bunch of transfer partners for the first time too. So this isn't just a reduction in your travel expenses. There is some theory, if you want to put a little more work into it, there are some ways to transfer these points and get a bunch of value.
Absolutely. Yeah, they partnered with some international airlines, so you can get massive value out of this. And many times, like, the high sign-up bonuses come with those premier credit cards that, you know, require $300, $400, $500 annual fees. This one is just a $95 annual fee waived for the first year. So that's also one benefit of these two cards.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I do talk to a decent amount of folks who are just getting into the sort of credit card game, and they don't really want to start with a card with a $400 or $500 annual fee because they haven't really figured out how to get that kind of value yet. So it takes them some time. And $95 is, I think, much more approachable for folks.
Right. With the caveat that there is a high minimum spend to earn these miles for both of these offers. So if, you know, you're every, you know, Joe Schmo family that puts on, you know, $1,002 and spend a month, this might not be the card for you. But for those business spenders out there, this is a great offer.
Yeah, it's one that I should probably get off my butt and get around to applying for.
Yes, you absolutely should. I'm probably not going to just because of the high minimum spend. I'm putting my spend elsewhere for 2019, but
all right, so what else do you have your eyes on right now?
So one, or actually four offers that I've been talking about a lot on my blog are the Southwest credit cards. So there's three personal cards, one business card, and I talk about Southwest a lot on this podcast and on my blog, so you probably heard me speak about why these offers are so good. But the main reason I love these offers, aside from the free travel, is that they count towards earning a companion pass. And the companion pass, just as a quick snippet, allows you to have a friend, family member, anyone you find off the street, travel with you for free an unlimited number of times for the length of the pass. So if you earn the pass in January 2019, it's valid for almost 2 years until December 31st of 2020. So if you apply for two of those cards, it'll give you up to 120,000 points and the companion pass right off the bat.
Yeah, now's a really good time to be thinking about that sort of stuff as we're just getting into the beginning of 2019. Even a couple months earlier would have been even better if you time it so that you just get those last points to earn the companion pass right at the beginning of 2019. But suffice to say, Jen's been on here a bunch talking about Southwest over the year that we've had the podcast up, and she is, you know, by far my go-to when it comes to questions about Southwest. So plenty of posts on her website to talk about the value of the companion pass and how best to maximize it. What else is on your radar for right now for credit card offers?
One of my other personal favorites is the Barclaycard Arrival Plus. So they recently increased their offer a significant amount. And these are flexible points. So while you can't use them as your traditional hotel or airline miles, they're worth a fixed value. So with the sign-up offer, you're going to get 70,000 miles, which is worth a fixed $700. And I really like using these types of miles for things that wouldn't otherwise accept your traditional hotel or airline points. So for example, we're going for a ski weekend, and in the Northeast, there aren't many, you know, chain hotels right on the mountain. And we're able to use these points to wipe out our travel spend on a really nice hotel right at the base of the mountain that we wouldn't otherwise been able to use, you know, your Hyatt or Marriott points for.
Yeah. And for me, who has a one track mind, another great place to use points like this is Disney, where it's, you know, fairly difficult to use points.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Right away, that could cover $700 in Disney tickets.
Cool. Well, those are some great cards for folks to consider. And you've also got, you know, we're going to link to a post that Jen's got because there's a little bit more complexity there. You've got, there's another Capital One card to consider. You've also got a great offer on the United Mileage Plus Explorer card and another Amex offer to consider. Tons and tons of stuff to check out on Jen's blog about credit cards and credit card offers this month. Choose carefully because you probably can't have all nine, but there's probably something here for everyone. Would you agree, Jen?
I agree. Absolutely.
Cool. Well, when you're not hopping on the podcast with me every week, tell folks where they can find you.
Sure. You can find me at my blog, dealswelike.com. And then also feel free to send me a note, dealswelike@gmail.com, via social media, anything at dealswelike. And I'll be happy to help you with anything.
Awesome. We'll have you back on the show soon. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
While we're taking a quick break from the show, I wanted to let you know about my other podcast, the Now Boarding Podcast. It's the official boarding area podcast, and it's where we dive in and get to know each of the boarding area bloggers that you follow with a 30-minute sit-down where we go deep into how they like to travel, why they started traveling, and the sort of things that they're an expert on. Each episode focuses on one individual blogger, and we put out a new episode every Tuesday. So if you're enjoying Miles to Go and you want to find more great travel bloggers to follow along with, tune in. You can find Now Boarding on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you find great podcasts. Now, back to the show. back on the Miles to Go podcast. And, you know, you hear me talk a lot about loyalty, miles and points, airlines, hotels here. And I do spend quite a bit of time in Vegas. The thing is that over the last number of years, Vegas has become less of a gambling destination and more of an everyone destination. There's stuff for everyone to do there. And the interesting thing is while I'm not as big a gambler as I used to be, it's still obviously a big part of Vegas, and I'm always curious about it. And my buddy Michael Traeger, who's been on the show before, wrote up a post recently that I think really frames up well the changes and how that's hurting some folks in Vegas. And so he agreed to jump on with us today to sort of walk through that so you guys can understand what the landscape looks like. And Michael, this is your second time on the Miles to Go podcast, so welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to speak at Zorkfest with you last year, your conference in Las Vegas that combined casino loyalty and hotel loyalty. And I think, you know, when I read your post a few days ago, you know, the title is, you know, very straightforward, embrace all gamblers, you know, love it, why casino loyalty is broken. And then, of course, the first header is just priceless. Nobody wants to be a sucker.
You like that, right? And it's sort of true, you know. And I think it resonates with people, you know, when they're looking for travel deals. But it especially resonates for people who are gamblers. And one of the things that you have to look at, I mean, that I keep hearing from a lot of people is who are gamblers. So they're people who are mostly drawn to Vegas because they're gamblers. Or they enjoy recreational gambling as a part of their vacation, that they're not getting the value out of Vegas that they used to get. And now they're considering they're taking fewer trips. Now, a big part of that is that almost everybody in the United States is now within 2 hours of driving distance from a casino. So obviously,
for sure.
So obviously the landscape's changed a little bit. I mean, flashback to, you know, 1979 or 1980, there were two places you could gamble in the United States, Atlantic City and the state of Nevada. and otherwise you went to the Caribbean. So, you know, and then slowly, you know, casinos started opening in other jurisdictions, you know, in the early 1990s. So it was a much different situation. And now you pretty much don't have casinos everywhere. I mean, actually, people are often surprised, and unless it's changed recently, the second largest casino market in the United States is Pennsylvania. And you say, right. Pennsylvania. And you think, yeah. I don't even, you know, when you go back long enough in talking about casinos, it doesn't even like dawn on you, like, wow, Pennsylvania, they're, you know, that's like new. I mean, it's very interesting. And one of the things that we talk about with regard to value that gamblers, you know, that gamblers want in Las Vegas is you have two separate issues here, which is a little bit different than regular travel loyalty. One is value of the games, and also is value of the loyalty program. So the first big set of devaluations in Las Vegas is when the casinos really devalued the games, especially for lower limit players. They introduced things like 6-to-5 blackjack, which has a much higher house edge. They made the video poker pay tables worse at lower denominations. You know, they did a whole bunch. They raised table limits. They introduced more carnival games. And you would have thought, wow, they're making all of this changing, all of these changes to gambling. It's going to scare away the gamblers. And the amazing thing is people still want to go to Vegas and still want to, you know, want to gamble in Vegas, and they've accepted these devaluations.
But yeah, well, now, Vegas is still Vegas. Yeah, it's still a target destination for so many people.
Right. So I thought Vegas was going to totally kill themselves by devaluing the games, but they sort of got away with that. And people like, I mean, you'll notice on a lot of games now, there are all kinds of interesting side bets, as even at blackjack or a pie gow or a baccarat. So, and those side bets always have very, very high house edges, which means that casino is going to make a lot more money off of those bets. But people, you know, people are still gambling there. But then come the loyalty program devaluations. And that's when you, really start to wonder, it's like, wow, you've really hit people with, you know, devaluing the games. And now you're going to devalue the loyalty programs or make the loyalty programs less compelling for people. And that was sort of the impetus when I wrote that article and saying, wow, I can't, you know, this is getting crazy, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, and just to give folks an example, because it's something that I've covered on my blog a number of times, you know, one of the ways that we've, you know, that we've seen this change significantly is the pay for parking. You know, that you know, parking used to be free everywhere in Vegas, and now it's free almost nowhere.
Yeah, well, and you know, here's the interesting thing, and I made a parallel with somebody recently. Usually the goal of when you look at a loyalty program, when you're loyal in a loyalty program, you usually move up tiers. You get some kind of status. So say in Caesar's Total Rewards, you know, you start at gold, you go platinum, you go diamond, you go 7 stars, M Life, you know, same kind of thing. You've got pearl and gold and platinum. So if you're a member of an airline program and you get status, usually you start to get some fees waived. You get some nice perks from that, right? You get status, and now all of a sudden you get a free check bag, right? That's sort of cool. So it's sure. May actually say, you know, this tier benefit is great. And I'm not going to argue the conceptual issue of resort fees. You know, yes, of course I don't like resort fees, but I'm pretty much so accepting that they're not going anywhere in Vegas. I mean, that they're pretty much so here to stay unless somebody steps in or the government steps in and there's some regulation that goes in which causes them to not be able to do it anymore or change the way resort fees are marketed. But you would think that when you have people who are elite members of the loyalty program, that would at least provide things like the free parking and the waivers of resort fees. And it's done on a small level, like Hilton. I said Hilton, that's crazy. I don't know why I'm in a Hilton. I've been thinking about a lot of Hilton things this week. Story. But when you think of Total Rewards, you know, Diamond, you know, what's so valuable about the Diamond tier is Diamond gets waived resort fees. So that's a really good perk, because you know, this is the thing that makes resort fees look even worse for gamblers. Gamblers often get comped rooms. So for those who don't know, you know, what comp is, a complimentary room. So your room is $0. Some of these resort fees reach as high as $45. So now the room, maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago, used to be zero. You used to pay that and maybe a little bit of tax on top of it. Now your $0 room is actually $40 a night because of a resort fee. Talk about a real devaluation there. I mean, that's
sure.
So Caesars has done a pretty good job with Diamond, but I still contend, if you're going to, you know, you can get comped rooms if you're gold or platinum. I still contend if you're going to give a casino customer a complimentary room because you believe through a marketing offer, or you believe they gambled enough their last trip or whatever, if you're going to give them a complimentary room, the resort fee should be waived on complimentary rooms. It just makes sense. Something that's free shouldn't have a resort fee on it, you know, especially because, you know, and this is the other part of it with gamblers, which becomes very interesting. You know, what are gamblers going to do if you give them more money in their pocket? You know, and people are talking about visiting Vegas and getting value out of Vegas. Most likely, if you can get them to come to Vegas and they feel they're getting good value, like a free room without a resort fee, they're probably going to use that extra money to gamble or spend at your property anyway. But
so, and I agree, and I think even if they're not going to gamble, they're probably going to dine in one of the, you know, many fabulous restaurants that didn't exist 20 years ago. So, you know, waiving resort fees is definitely a great way for them to move down this path. What else do you think casinos can do to re-energize gamblers and customers to be more loyal?
They need to start to provide more incentives for guests to stay within their property. I talk about this quite often. And it's amazing that enough properties don't do this, especially you bring a casino guest in or a small gambler. And the casino guests, it's really important to differentiate. I'm not talking big gamblers here. I'm talking relatively average recreational gamblers, which the casinos do market to. And in a market like Vegas, which is highly competitive with a lot of hotel rooms, they do offer complimentary or highly discounted rooms throughout the year. So we're not talking anybody who's a mega high-level gambler who is gambling on a $25,000 bankroll or something like that. We're really talking more ordinary recreational gamblers. So part of my thesis on all of this are a couple of things that people that the casino should be doing. They should be driving people with incentives to stay, to dine and do things in their property. They should be doing it in an intelligent way because they have that data. They also should be customizing and feeding things to mobile to customers in a real-time situation. So if you've left the blackjack table and you were just playing blackjack for 6.5 hours, there is no reason why the casino, because you've signed in with your loyalty program, of course, for them to track your blackjack play, there's no reason for the casino, after you finish that session, they immediately know how long you've been gambling and how you've been gambling, to offer you a promotion that you can drop into your Google or Apple wallet for a discount. Maybe like, you know, hey, I saw you were, you know, you were just playing blackjack for 6 hours and right, maybe it's breakfast time now. Why don't you visit, you know, this restaurant? Here's a coupon that's good for 2 hours to visit this restaurant for breakfast for 75% off because we value your business and you were just gambling. And you can do all of this stuff so seamlessly through mobile now and so intelligently. And there's just not a lot of it being done.
Well, and I would imagine too that at least some of the folks, if you're using that example you just gave, if you gave, you know, 100 customers that free breakfast voucher, some portion of them are going to go have breakfast and come back and gamble, whereas the rest of them are probably going to go somewhere else.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing becomes, you know, especially in a place like Vegas. Think about it for a moment. If you're staying at Paris, Las Vegas, you know, if you're not given an incentive to have breakfast there, or maybe to have drinks there at the end of the day, you have so many options that you could walk to or go to in Vegas. You're not going to, you know, why are you going to stay on property if you're not giving people additional incentives to stay there? I mean, the other thing that I think would be interesting is that I think they should really start to produce more compelling upgrade offers for suites. And that's another idea. And I think Vegas is the perfect market for this because most hotels, and I mean, we could probably talk about this a lot. And I know in the blogger community, people talk about suite upgrades and, you know, loyalty programs like Hyatt and when you're guaranteed suite upgrades or not. But, you know, the biggest problem with suite upgrades most of the time is inventory of suites at hotels. The average hotel does not have very many suites because the average hotel is not that large. Right. Well, what's beautiful about Vegas is these hotels are gargantuan and they actually have an enormous number of suites just by virtue of the fact that, you know, most normal hotels don't have 2,500 rooms, right? So having a good number of suites, and people are very interested in that. And I think that's another, you know, thing that should be done in a smart technological way. And you know, my suggestion there is it also should be integrated with, you know, loyalty challenges to make a game out of it. You know, sort of like, you know, you're going to check in on your mobile and you get an upgrade and say, hey, we'll give you this upgrade for, you know, you can this suite upgrade would regularly be to regular people $100 a night. But since you're platinum, we're going to give you $25 off all of the suite upgrades that we're offering you today. So your upgrade on this $100 a night suite upgrade is $75 a night. But if you earn 1500 tier points during your stay, we'll comp, you know, then we'll wipe out the charge for your suite upgrade. I mean, how cool would that be? And how much would people like it? And the thing, this is a really big differentiation I make. And this is one of my, I'm really a fan of monetization. I know someone's going to shoot me about this, but you know, like airlines like Delta that are really trying to monetize the first class cabin, I am all gung-ho. I think it's the greatest thing ever. But I think you should offer a better level of how you're monetizing that also to your diamonds and your platinums and your gold. You shouldn't lock them out. I do not like the idea of monetizing upgrades to the general public and then not offering your diamonds and platinums those. And then when all the first class seats are gone because you've monetized and sold all these upgrades, the people who are supposed to be getting the quotation free upgrades aren't getting them. That I'm not a fan of. So I think they're...
Yeah, we could definitely go like way down the rabbit hole on airlines and how they do their upgrades. But I do think, you know, from a casino standpoint, you've really outlined some very key areas where they could improve. I think, you know, the concern I always have with this is we talk about this frequently in the airline and hotel space is, you know, will the programs make these sorts of changes, or do they feel like they're able to monetize these areas in other ways and they don't see the impact? I think that's always the fear that I have, but you know, there's always hope. And while things don't get better often, they sometimes do. And I guess that's where we'll have to leave it, to hope that they do. And before we kick you out, I want to ask you one more thing, because I saw something in passing, and I understand that from the website, it still looks like you guys are under a beta, but what can you tell me about Wayfarer points? You know, I like saving money, and you know, I like saving money on hotel stays, but I don't know what's going on here. So what's the 30-second version?
The 30-second version, that there are a number of different things going on with Wayfarer points, but the core concept is to gamify loyalty in what I would consider to be a compelling and competitive way, basically socializing the way that you deal with loyalty and making how you collect loyalty points competitive amongst your friends. Competitive and social, you know, and social with your friends and also other people in the world who aren't your friends. From that point, that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is really driving a premium component with amazing deals. And we're really keen on that, keen on, you know, developing amazing travel deals that you could book seamlessly via mobile. And actually, one of our testers saved quite a few $1,000s in hotel bookings over approximately a 1 year period using some of the things that we've been testing. But, you know, this comes back to one of my biggest concepts, which I know you've educated people on. It's so important for people to understand when great revenue rates for hotels make more sense than using your miles and points. So we're sort of, I love educating on that. And that's a big area of Wayfarer, because it's driving really good revenue deals in addition to the gamification.
Okay. And I love it. And you know, I love saving money, but you still didn't answer my question. How do I get access? Come on, man. There's got to be a way to get in. Come on, this is me. How do I get in?
You didn't tell me the rule when I do these podcasts is that I have to answer your question. If you told me I was going to have to answer the question, I might have not come on. What you need to do is go to wayfarerpoints.com, and you just need to sign up for a beta release. You also need to follow Wayfarer Points on Twitter, like it on Facebook, just to get some updates. And as soon as the beta is ready, you'll be able to be in one of the first groups to give this thing a try. So I would highly suggest.
And again, he's not letting me in. All right. Well, we're gonna end it there, but I am gonna continue to bug you, because I am gonna find my way in one way or another. Michael, thanks a ton for being on the podcast today.
It was my pleasure, and have a really terrific day.
When you're not hanging out with me, tell folks where they can find you.
They can find me at TravelZork, and that's really pretty easy. TravelZork.com, TravelZork on Twitter, TravelZork on Facebook, and we also have a really fun Facebook group, which is TravelZork Zorkcast Facebook group, where we chat about some of these things. A lot of it's casino loyalty oriented.
There you have it. Thanks again, Michael. We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast. Back on the Miles to Go podcast to wrap up this week's show with the final two pennies. It's 2019, so time to work on our New Year's resolutions. For 2019, I want to make sure you have a goal and a plan for how to achieve it. And we're not talking financial planning. We're talking vacation planning. What else would we talk about on this show? Pick a place that you want to go, or pick a few places. I'm okay with either. Then let's map out the strategy. If you're not a business traveler, we'll have to rely on other means to earn those miles and points, which is most of us. My friend Summer from TPG is a radical planner. She'll tell you that you should already be mapping out vacations for 2020. I'll tell you there's no way I'm ever that far ahead. So build your plans for what works for you. If your 2019 and 2020 goals involve the domestic U.S. and Hawaii or the Caribbean, the early part of 2019 can be a great time to apply for a Southwest credit card or two to help you earn an annual a companion pass. We've covered the companion pass on this podcast more than once with Jen from Deals We Like. It's, to me, the single best benefit from a domestic airline. Have your eyes set a bit further away? Credit cards that earn flexible currency like Chase Ultimate Rewards, American Express, and even Capital One now might be a good fit to get you to Asia or Europe or South America. We want to make sure that the bonus categories for these cards align with what you spend on most. We want to maximize what you do already and have credit cards help us do that. And we're going to need to find unconventional ways to earn points. I talked to Michael Traeger a little bit before we started recording this week's episode about Wayfarer points, something that he's been working on. He won't tell me much, but it sounds like it has the potential to be a true helper for folks who earn most of their miles without stepping foot on an airplane. We'll stay tuned for more info on that in January and February and bring it to you live here on the podcast. Are you a business traveler? Well, with loyalty programs overall less rewarding, you'll need to pay more attention to promotions this year as well as changes in the marketplace. The new Hilton promotion we discussed this week is a good example of a way to stack up some points on stays you already have. It very well may be the most rewarding hotel promo that we see in the first quarter of 2019. January is a bit late, but still a great time to make sure that your leisure travel goals in 2019 align with your business travel choices. That's a full wrap on this week's episode. If you've got a question that we can help answer in 2019, send us an email, or you can use the new orange tab on our website to leave us a voicemail. Head to milestogo.boardingarea.com and click on the send voicemail tab, and we'll get your question answered in a future episode. I want to thank Grant, Jen, and Michael for helping me put together a great show for you guys this week. I've got interviews coming up with Stephanie Rosenblum, New York Times columnist. We'll also touch base with a friend who had all the miles stolen out of one of his accounts. And we'll catch up with Gene Hoffman to talk about Spirit Airlines and how they're improving. We're already putting together a great show for next week. But until then, we've got miles to go.